Many of the master chemists who supervised the conversion were Chinese brought in specially from Hong Kong. In a June 1971 report, the CIA said that conversion from number 3 to number 4 heroin production in the Golden Triangle, quote, appears to be due to the sudden increase in demand by a large and relatively affluent market in South Vietnam, unquote. By mid-April 1971, demand for number 4 heroin both in Vietnam and the United States had increased so quickly that the wholesale price for a kilo jumped to $1,780 from $1,240 the previous September. Once large quantities of heroin became available to American GIs in Vietnam, heroin addiction spread like a plague. Previously non-existent in South Vietnam, suddenly number 4 heroin was everywhere. 14-year-old girls were selling heroin at roadside stands on the main highway from Saigon to the U.S. Army base at Long Binh. Saigon street peddlers stuffed plastic vials of 95% pure heroin into the pockets of GIs as they strolled through downtown Saigon. And Mama Sans, or Vietnamese barracks maids, started carrying a few vials to work for sale to on-duty GIs. With this kind of aggressive sales campaign, the results were predictable. In September of 1970, Army medical officers questioned 3,103 soldiers of the AmeriCal Division and discovered that 11.9% had tried heroin since they came to Vietnam, and 6.6% were still using it on a regular basis. In November, a U.S. engineering battalion in the Mekong Delta reported that 14% of its troops were on heroin. By mid-1971, U.S. Army medical officers were estimating that about 10 to 15%, or 25 to 37,000 of the lower-ranking enlisted men serving in Vietnam were heroin users. As base after base was overrun by these ant armies of heroin pushers with their identical plastic vials, GIs and officers alike started asking themselves why this was happening. Who was behind this heroin plague? The North Vietnamese were frequently blamed, and wild rumors started floating around U.S. installations about huge heroin factories in Hanoi, truck convoys rumbling down the Ho Chi Minh Trail loaded with cases of plastic vials, and heroin-crazed North Vietnamese regulars making suicide charges up the slopes of Khe San with syringes stuck in their arms. However, the U.S. Army Provost Marshal laid such rumors to rest in a 1971 report which said in part, quote, the opium-growing areas of North Vietnam are concentrated in mountainous northern provinces bordering China. Cultivation is closely controlled by the government, and none of the crop is believed to be channeled illicitly into international markets. Much of it is probably converted into morphine and used for medical purposes. Instead, the provost marshal accused high-ranking members of South Vietnam's government of being the top zone, unquote, in a four-tiered heroin pushing pyramid. Zone 1, located at the top or apex of the pyramid, contains the financiers or backers of the illicit drug traffic in all its forms. The people comprising this group may be high-level, influential political figures, government leaders, or moneyed ethnic Chinese members of the criminal syndicates now flourishing in the Cholon sector of the city of Saigon. The members comprising this group are the powers behind the scenes who can manipulate, foster, protect, and promote the illicit traffic in drugs. And the point being here that the American GIs were being addicted in Vietnam, and as we're about to look at now, one of the dominant forces in that addiction was none other than the elements of the very Vietnamese government those GIs were there to protect, primarily those around Nguyen Cao Ky. Nguyen Cao Ky was president of the Vietnamese Republic at one point, for a long time was vice president under Chu. He was also head of the Vietnamese Air Force, and in that capacity was able to insert himself right into the center of the narcotics traffic.
As we shall see also, at this point, the American military and political leaders in Vietnam, who were there instructing the forces in Vietnam, began to realize that they were having were going to have real difficulty controlling the populace of South Vietnam. As we have said many times, and many other people besides us have observed, South Vietnam was not so much a nation as it was a group of people receiving U.S. assistance in order to sort of stay in large groups and keep the North Vietnamese out, and even more importantly, keep the Viet Cong out, who were largely South Vietnamese. In other words, the people who also lived in South Vietnam and who happened to be opposed to the government in Saigon. This was becoming more and more an untenable position for the U.S. to support a government that had no popular support itself among its people, and more money and more underworld activity was needed to support this kind of effort to keep the populace under control.
Now, it's worth noting that Viet Cong activity in Saigon was increasing dramatically. In order to combat this, basically what the United States did was to reinstall a security system that had been largely operating under the French with Operation X. Basically, the very same criminal syndicates that had figured prominently in the French security service, such as the Bin Zhen River Pirates that we talked about, were repressed into service basically as, again, an anti-communist cadre. The system that had been put together before, and which had, you know, as far as it went, instituted a very effective security in Saigon against the Viet Cong, basically entailed an all-pervasive system of corruption. Basically, criminal syndicates were given a free hand to corrupt anybody and everybody they could. What they did was to literally establish a community of graft whereby everybody was corrupted, everybody was in on the take, and in exchange for this, they provided information and became, in essence, anti-communist informants. This was, as an anti-communist tactic, or at least as an anti-terrorism tactic, was very effective. However, it basically created literally a criminal community in Vietnam, which in Saigon, which embraced not only the top officials, but just about everybody. Everybody literally was on the take. That's what made it so effective. So what they were really doing, in effect, was criminalizing the entire society. Now, Nguyen Cao Ky, again, at one time president, another time vice president of the Vietnamese Republic, also head of the Air Force in Vietnam, and currently, by the way, living in the United States and reportedly involved in criminal activities, including narcotics trafficking in the United States. Nguyen Cao Ky and his assistant, General Nguyen Nhoc Loan, oversaw this system, and financing this all-pervasive system of corruption and intelligence was, you guessed it, the opium traffic.
Reading from Alfred McCoy's book. Although he was enormously popular with the Air Force, Ky had neither an independent political base nor any claim to leadership of a genuine mass movement when he took office. This was the office of Premier, the highest political office in South Vietnam. A relative newcomer to politics, Ky was hardly known outside elite circles. Also, Ky seemed to lack the money, the connections, and the capacity for intrigue necessary to build up an effective ruling faction and restore Saigon's security. But he solved these problems in the traditional Vietnamese manner by choosing a power broker, a, quote, heavy, as Machiavellian and corrupt as Bay Vien or Ngo Dinh Diu. This man was General Nguyen Nhoc Loan, L-O-A-N. Loan was easily the brightest of the young Air Force officers. His career was marked by rapid advancement and assignment to such technically demanding jobs as commander of the Light Observation Group and assistant commander of the Tactical Operations Center. Loan also had served as deputy commander to Ky, an old classmate and friend, in the aftermath of the anti-Diem coup. Shortly after Ky took office, he appointed Loan director of the Military Security Service, the MSS. Since MSS was responsible for anti-corruption investigations inside the military, Loan was in an excellent position to protect members of Ky's faction. Several months later, Loan's power increased significantly when he was also appointed director of the Central Intelligence Organization, CIO, which was South Vietnam's CIA, without being asked to resign from the MSS. Finally, in April 1966, Premier Ky announced that General Loan had been appointed to an additional post, Director General of the National Police. Only after Loan had consolidated his position and handpicked his successors did he, quote, step down as director of the MSS and CIO. Not even under Diem had one man controlled so many police and intelligence agencies. In the appointment of Loan to all three posts, the interests of Ky and the Americans coincided. While Premier Ky was using Loan to build up a political machine, the U.S. mission was happy to see a strong man take command of, quote, Saigon's police and intelligence communities, unquote, to drive the NLF out of the capital. Lieutenant Colonel Lucien Conin says that Loan was given wholehearted U.S. support because, quote, we wanted effective security in Saigon above all else, and Loan could provide that security. Loan's activities were placed beyond reproach, and the whole three-tiered U.S. advisory structure at the district, province, and national level was placed at his disposal. The liberal naivete that had marked the Kennedy diplomats in the last few months of Diem's regime was decidedly absent. Gone were the qualms about, quote, police state tactics and daydreams that Saigon could be secure and politics, quote, stabilized without using funds available from the control of Saigon's lucrative rackets. With the encouragement of Ky and the tacit support of the U.S. mission, Loan, whom the Americans called Laughing Larry because he frequently burst into a high-pitched giggle, revived the Bin Zoyan formula for using systematic corruption to combat urban guerrilla warfare. Rather than purging the police and intelligence bureaus, Lawn forged an alliance with a specialist who had been running these agencies for the last 10 to 15 years. According to Lieutenant Colonel Conane, quote, the same professionals who organized corruption for GM and NU were still in charge of police and intelligence. Lawn simply passed the word among these guys and put the old system back together again, unquote. Under Lawn's direction, Saigon's security improved markedly. With the, quote, door-to-door surveillance network perfected by Dr. Tuyen back in action, police were soon swamped with information. A U.S. Embassy official, Charles Sweet, who was then engaged in urban pacification work, recalls that in 1965 the NLF was actually holding daytime rallies in the 6th, 7th, and 8th districts of Cholon, and terrorist incidents were running over 40 a month in District 8 alone. Lawn's methods were so effective, however, that from October 1966 until January 1968, there was not a single terrorist incident in District 8. In January 1968, correspondent Robert Chaplin reported that Lawn, quote, has done what is generally regarded as a good job of tracking down communist terrorists in Saigon, unquote. Putting the old system back together again, of course, meant reviving large-scale corruption to finance the cash rewards paid to these part-time agents whenever they delivered information. Lawn and the police intelligence professionals systematized the corruption, regulating how much each particular agency would collect, how much each officer would skim off for his personal use, and what percentage would be turned over to Key's political machine. Excessive individual corruption was rooted out, and Saigon Cholon's vice rackets, protection rackets, and payoffs were strictly controlled. After several years of watching Lawn's system in action, Charles Sweet feels that there were four major sources of graft in South Vietnam. 1. Sale of government jobs by generals or their wives. 2. Administrative corruption, graft, kickbacks, bribes, etc. 3. Military corruption, theft of goods and payroll frauds. And 4. The opium traffic. And, out of the four, Sweet has concluded that the opium traffic was undeniably the most important source of illicit revenue.
Now, we looked at how American GIs were being addicted to heroin, being flown in by the CIA via Air America, grown in Laos by the CIA's so-called secret Hmong or Mayo army, and basically that the dominant traffickers in South Vietnam, at whose behest all of this was being done. Of course, it was being used to finance the arms and fighting capacity of the Hmong, but the people involved in turning this heroin traffic around in Vietnam were the group of Vietnamese officials and soldiers and flyers around Nguyen Cao Ky, and this was the dominant individual responsible for getting all of these GIs addicted. Continuing, and again, Nguyen Cao Ky, the dominant person involved in the heroin traffic, or the opium traffic, from Laos to Vietnam, and consequently winding up in the veins of the GIs. Continuing with McCoy's account. Of South Vietnam's three major narcotics rings, the air transport wing loyal to Air Vice Marshal Ky must still be considered the most professional. Although Ky's apparatus lost control over the internal distribution network following his post-Tet political decline in 1968, his faction continues to manage much of the narcotics smuggling between Vietnam and Laos through the Air Force and its relations with Laotian traffickers. With over 10 years of experience, it has connections with the Lao elite that the other two factions cannot even hope to equal. Rather than buying heroin through a maze of middlemen, Ky's apparatus deals directly with a heroin laboratory operating somewhere in the Vientiane region. According to a U.S. police advisor stationed in Vientiane, this laboratory is supposed to be one of the most active in Laos and is managed by a Chinese entrepreneur named Hu Tim Heng. Heng is the link between one of Laos's major opium merchants, General Juan Ratikon, former commander-in-chief of the Laotian army, and the air transport wing heroin ring. From the viewpoint of the narcotics traffic, Hu Tim Heng's most important legitimate commercial venture is the Pepsi-Cola bottling factory on the outskirts of Vientiane. With Prime Minister Suvarnabhumi's son Panya as the official president, Heng and two other Chinese financiers began construction in 1965 and 6. Although the presence of the Prime Minister's son at the head of the company qualified the venture for generous financial support from USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the plant has still not bottled a single Pepsi after 5 years of stop-start construction. The completed factory building has a forlorn, abandoned look about it. While Pepsi's competitors are mystified at the company's lackadaisical attitude, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics has an answer to the riddle. Bureau sources report that Heng has been using his Pepsi operation as a cover for purchases of chemicals vital to the processing of heroin, such as ether and acetic anhydride, and for large financial transactions. Once the heroin is processed and packaged in large plastic envelopes, other experienced members of the key apparatus take charge of arranging shipment to South Vietnam. Mrs. Nguyen T. Lee, Key's older sister, last name, by the way, T-H-I-L-Y, Key's elder sister had directed much of the traffic from the Sedon Palace Hotel in Pak Se while her brother was premier. But in 1967, she gave up her position as manager and moved back to Saigon. However, sources in Vientiane's Vietnamese community report that she and her husband have traveled between Saigon, Pak Se, and Vientiane at least once a month since they returned to Vietnam. Mrs. Lee purchases heroin produced in Hu Tim Heng's clandestine laboratory and has it shipped to Pak Se or Phnom Penh, where it is picked up by Vietnamese Air Force transports. In addition, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics believes that General Lone's old assistant, Mai Den, may also be involved in this operation. After General Lone was wounded in May of 1968, Mai Den was forced out of his position as director of the CIO's Foreign Intelligence Bureau, and he exiled himself to Bangkok. For 2 years, this wily chameleon had used his CIO agents to weave a net of drug contacts across the Golden Triangle, and the Bureau of Narcotics has reason to believe he may still be using them. Normally, those Air Force officers responsible for directing the flow of narcotics to South Vietnam purchase the drugs and have them delivered, often by the Laotian Air Force, to points in Laos, particularly Pak Se, or else across the border in Pleiku Province, South Vietnam, or in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Most observers feel that the Cambodian capital has preempted Pleiku's importance as a drop point since the Vietnamese Air Force began daily sorties to Phnom Penh during the 1970 Cambodia invasion. In August of 1971, The New York Times reported that the director of Vietnam Customs, quote, said he believed that planes of the South Vietnamese Air Force were the principal carriers of heroin coming into South Vietnam, unquote. While the director is a two appointee and his remark may be politically motivated, U.S. Customs more objective observers, have stated that the Air Force regularly unloads large quantities of smuggled narcotics at Tanzanut Air Base. Here, Air Vice Marshal Key reigns like a feudal baron in his air-conditioned palace, surrounded by only his most loyal officers. As one U.S. Air Force advisor put it, quote, in order to get a job within shooting distance of the vice presidential palace, a VNAF officer has to be intensely loyal to Key. So summing up this passage that we just finished reading, not only are the Hmong tribesmen, the CIA's so-called secret army, growing the opium in Laos, not only is CIA's Air America flying it in to South Vietnam, but the key traffickers in Vietnam, and of course remember that the key victims and addicts are American GIs, the key traffickers in Vietnam are the key elements of the government, and key there is not meant as a pun, specifically Nguyen Cao Ky, Air Vice Marshal, head of the Vietnamese Air Force, one-time President of the Republic, for a long time Vice President under General Chu, and it's worth noting that the main refinery from which the key ring is getting, that's a great point, from which the key narcotics organization is getting its heroin and its opium, is being bottled at a plant which is ostensibly a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant. It is not actually a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant. It is actually a heroin laboratory. Nonetheless, that heroin laboratory, again, being used by the key narcotics organization, by the Hmong tribes, and by CIA to fly heroin into South Vietnam, where it's going into the veins of our GIs, that plant is being subsidized by the U.S. Agency for International Development, itself often used as a conduit for U.S. intelligence. And Niptuck's going to give you a very piece of interesting information about a well-known American politician who played a very important role in getting that plant set up.
I can tell us late in the show, a very piece of information interesting. A very interesting information. We'll try that one again. We both got it wrong. A very interesting piece of information. This is from The Great Heroin Coup by Henry Krueger. Just a short segment. In August 1971, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs announced the location in Southeast Asia of 29 drug refineries, 15 of them allegedly producing heroin. Among the largest was one in Vientiane, Laos, which was camouflaged as a Pepsi-Cola plant. Richard Nixon, representing Pepsi's interests in 1965, had promoted its construction. Though the plant never capped a bottle, it continued to be subsidized by U.S. Aid for International Development. So Richard Nixon, who at the time of, among other things, the Kennedy assassination, was working for the Pepsi-Cola company, it was the one who promoted the foundation of that plant in Vientiane, which became the leading heroin refinery in all of Southeast Asia, never capped a bottle of Pepsi. The heroin, as Dave said, went straight into the arms of American GIs, and yet the American taxpayer supported it through the USAID.
And again, the main person trafficking in that heroin, which was going into the arms of the GIs, was Nien Khao Ky, a key official of the government that those GIs were there to support in the first place. Obviously a distasteful situation. We're going to conclude this particular Radio Free America broadcast by taking a look at something which in a sense will provide a bridge to future programs, namely the evolution of the Southeast Asian heroin traffic into a Southeast Asian heroin production operation into a major exporter of heroin to the crime syndicates bringing it into the United States. Not only is it being used to supply the habits of American GIs, via the Southeast Asian heroin opium fields, eventually were to become a major factor in supplying the domestic American addict's habit. By the way, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. And remember now, the key organization's role, that is KY organization's role, in the narcotics trafficking, because apparently the U.S. authorities in Vietnam, particularly General Edward Lansdale, one of the prime architects of America's military and political policy there, decided to overlook the role of the Corsican Syndicate in the Saigon heroin trafficking and in the Southeast Asian role in general. The Corsicans, obviously, Vietnam was a French, Indochina was a French colony. The Corsicans wound up there as well. And the Corsicans and the Vietnamese heroin traffic, as the Corsicans began contracting with Nien Khao Ky to get Vietnamese heroin sent to their Marseille laboratories, American authorities decided to overlook this connection. And we're going to take a look at Santo Traficante, who made a trip to Saigon and may very well have been involved with getting Vietnamese heroin himself. At any rate, this last passage is going to serve as sort of a bridge to our next broadcasts. This is the concluding passage for this program from Alfred McCoy's Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. It is particularly unfortunate that General Lansdale decided to arrange, quote, some kind of truce, unquote, with the Corsicans during the very period when Marseille's heroin laboratories were probably beginning the changeover from Turkish to Southeast Asian morphine base. In a mid-1971 interview, Lieutenant Colonel Conin said that power brokers and Premier Key's apparatus contacted the leaders of Saigon's Corsican underworld in 1965 and 6 and agreed to let them start making large drug shipments to Europe in exchange for a fixed percentage of the profits. By October of 1969, these shipments had become so important to Marseille's heroin laboratories that, according to Conin, there was a summit meeting of Corsican syndicate bosses from around the world at Saigon's Continental Palace Hotel. Syndicate leaders from Marseille, Bangkok, Vientiane, and Phnom Penh flew in for the meeting, which discussed a wide range of international rackets, but probably focused on reorganizing the narcotics traffic. According to one well-informed U.S. diplomat in Saigon, the U.S. Embassy has a reliable Corsican informant who claims that similar meetings were also held in 1968 and 1970 at the Continental Palace. Most significantly, American mafia boss Santo Traficante Jr. visited Saigon in 1968 and is believed to have contacted Corsican syndicate leaders there. Vietnamese police officials report that the current owner of the Continental Palace is Philippe Francini, the heir of Mathieu Francini, the reported organizer of currency and opium smuggling rackets between Saigon and Marseille during the First Indochina War. Police officials also point out that some of Key's strongest supporters in the Air Force, Transport Division Commander Colonel Fang Phong Tien, is close to many Corsican gangsters and has been implicated in the smuggling of drugs between Laos and Vietnam. From 1965 to 1967, General Lansdale's senior liaison office worked closely with Premier Key's administration, and the general himself was identified as one of the young premier's stronger supporters among U.S. mission personnel. One can only wonder whether Conin's and Lansdale's willingness to grant the Corsicans a truce, unquote, and overlook their growing involvement in the American heroin traffic might not have been motivated by political considerations, i.e., their fear of embarrassing Premier Key.
All right, so quick summation tonight. We realize that with these archive broadcasts, you're listening to an awful lot of strange names, especially tonight's broadcast with all the Italian and Corsican and French and Sicilian and now Laotian and Vietnamese and Thai names. That's very complicated. This is the reason, of course, that we advocate taping them. In just a moment, Dave is going to tell you about where you can get a tape if you were not able to tape this broadcast yourself. Just to cap the main high points, just so you can go away with this clear. We probably should call them
the most significant points in the present context.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to stay away from
Key. It's like talking about the key ring. You know?
Yeah, we're going to stay away from Key for the rest of the day. Capping the most significant points off. And What started as originally a marriage of convenience between American intelligence and the American military and certain underworld organizations, namely the Corsican Union Corse underworld gang and, of course, the Sicilian Mafia, after becoming originally a marriage of convenience for political purposes so that these groups could be used to suppress labor and leftist political organizations in Europe at the end of World War II, before very long, The intelligence forces of France and the United States found out how very valuable the opium traffic that these underworld gangs were involved in could be, and how very lucrative they could be in terms of being able to use the money to supply political forces. Of course, also the same thing happened in China, where Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence operation was based almost entirely upon drug-dealing gangs, and later when the United States began to have liaison directly with Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence chief, that liaison was in fact right through the same network and operations. So later on, when France and then after them the United States made Southeast Asia the focus of much of their policy for Asia and stopping communism, the combination of these things, the French connections into the opium traffic, and of course the profound involvement of Chiang Kai-shek's Chinese refugees, the KMT, the Kuomintang, meant that the United States would become more and more involved with the heroin traffic, and eventually, by the late 1950s and the mid-1960s, the United States was actively involved to the extent of having a CIA proprietary airline, Air America, actually flying Laotian opium down from the hills to the flatlands, and opium that later wound up being refined in a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant that was opened with the help of Richard Nixon and subsidized by the United States Aid for International Development, heroin that eventually wound up going into the arms and veins of United States GIs and coming back to the United States in the biggest heroin boom this country has ever seen.
Courteous of the courtesy of the people who we were there to defend in the first place.
Absolutely. And so now we're going to be looking in the next few broadcasts at some of the ways that heroin and cocaine and other drugs have become an intimate part of our intelligence establishment's political agenda.
Now, if for some reason you were unable to tape this broadcast, and I think you'll agree that it's a difficult program to simply try and assimilate by through casual listening, all of our archive shows, all, at this point, 24 Radio Free America shows, our Four Guns of November programs, and other miscellaneous broadcasts are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is DAVCORE, D-A-V as in Victor, K-O-R-E. They're located at Suite 1300 D, as in DAVCORE, Space Park Way. Three words just like it sounds, Space Park Way. It's right down by the NASA Ames facility. That's in Mountain View. The zip code is 94043. Phone number is area code 415-969-3030. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. Once again, DAVCORE, Suite 1300D, Space Park Way, Mountain View, California, 94043, area code 415-969-3030. And again, neither NIP nor myself nor KFJC makes a sou off of that. We don't make any money off of it. This is strictly, literally, FYI and for your convenience as well.
All right. Now, stay tuned for Radio Dada, which has graciously allowed us to run a few minutes over. That will be on until 2 o'clock in the morning. And we will be back Sunday with our regular One Step Beyond broadcast from 8 to 11. And as soon as we have a date in approximately 4 to 5 weeks from now for our next Radio Free America broadcast, we will give you that.
Right. Don't forget, by the way, Mae Brussels, World Watchers International, Sunday morning at 9. During the third hour of next One Step Beyond, we're going to be rebroadcasting the Mae Brussels tape that would normally have been broadcast this evening.
All right. Thank you for joining us. This is Nip Tuck for Dave Emery saying good night, and be back with us next time for more Radio Free America here on KFJC.